Good morning, everyone, and or evening, depending on what time you're listening. So it's Tim Ryan here. I'm a principal consultant with Aether, a consulting firm. And today I've got the chair of the Productivity Commission, Michael Brennan, here for an interview and a bit of a discussion. So welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be here.
So you commenced in your role as the chair of the PC around about 2 years ago in 2018 from previous roles in quite senior roles in the federal and Victorian state governments. And you moved into the PC, which is obviously a highly regarded and well-known institution, you know, taking on the top role there. So what were your thoughts on taking on that role in the first place? And, you know, 2 years into the role, how's that kind of playing out for you?
Yeah, well, I was obviously keenly anticipating the role, very pleased to get it. And yeah, nothing that I've seen or observed or experienced in the time since has changed that view. So when I came to the job, I guess I had been a long-standing supporter and consumer of the Productivity Commission's products and its predecessor's products. So I've been a great admirer of the work dating back to the early 90s, which I guess at the beginning of when I started to get interested in economic policy, the role of the industry, then Industry Commission, under Bill Carmichael, then Bill Scales, and then the advent of the PC under Gary Banks, and then its continuation under Peter Harris. And I was aware of, whilst I hadn't lived through it personally, the antecedents of the commission in the Tariff Board and the history of Alf Radigan and his famous rivalries with Black Jack McEwen and the like. You know, these are things you'd read about and sort of I'd kind of internalised as a young person as being sort of the great iconic chapters in Australian economic policy history. So it was a great privilege to have effectively accepted the mantle or the custodianship of such a great and important and iconic institution. And the things that I had always respected about the Commission were firstly the rigour that it brought to its analysis. And I've always seen, you know, rigorous analysis kind of having two blades, if you like, one being strong analytical or conceptual analysis, but the second being a commitment to evidence, real-world evidence. And the fact that the Commission had this institutionalised process of going out and gaining the views of stakeholders and testing them rigorously and but hearing them and trying to understand the industries in which they were operating, such that it wasn't, despite the critiques that sometimes arise, it's not an ivory tower institution. It's something that's out there listening to the real-world views of stakeholders on the ground. And I've always been impressed by that. I also think it's been an organisation that's been prepared to take a longer term view, and often that's involved a bit of unpopular but necessary policy advocacy. And that's a precious thing in our democracy because, let's face it, you know, there's always pressure to deal with issues and address them in the here and now. And I know from my time in both in government departments, but even in ministerial offices, you know, that what you want to know is that there's something there on the shelf when the time comes where someone's given a great deal of detailed thought to an issue that can give you a little bit of a roadmap such that what you're doing in the here and now is consistent with perhaps a good, solid, long-term policy path.
Actually, with that, the long-term view, how does that line up with the current, I suppose, pandemic situation where there probably is a much more shorter term focus in terms of, you know, the immediate here and now and the impacts and that kind of stuff? How do you, I suppose, maintain that longer term focus?
Yeah, well, it's been interesting, actually. I mean, the pandemic is a fast moving thing in every sense, and the policy response has been fast moving, and I think the general community attitude has been fast moving. When I think back to April of this year, you know, all of the focus was on the here and now, the immediate response, you know, and some big decisions being made, rolling out JobKeeper or the JobSeeker supplement, the closure of the borders, the various restrictions and the like. Big decisions having to be made quickly, and yeah, they're not necessarily things where the PC has a significant role to play, or where the traditional toolkit or approach that we would bring has a lot to offer. nonetheless, we did try and support decision making in that period a little bit, because we figured, well, we have some resources here, some strong, good economic minds and the like, that can be used to try and assist others as they grapple with these issues. So we've seconded a number of people into the Treasury. We've provided a bit of support to Treasury in terms of tasks where they might want a bit of additional thinking that we can do, and kind of send back some thoughts back to them as inputs into their policy advice and the like. So we've endeavoured to flex to make ourselves useful and adaptive to the situation. But I think since then things have shifted a bit, and there is much more focus now on the long term, partly because there's a realisation that coming out of the pandemic and as the economy ultimately recovers, there are two things. One is that the economy will not go back to its precise form of January, February 2020, and hence there's a need for a degree of reallocation in the economy. There's a big question mark about how you efficiently and speedily encourage that and facilitate that reallocation of resources across the economy. And also that beyond that, in a new, what you might describe as a new steady state, there's just going to be a need for more pro-growth settings, because we will be in a world of a big fiscal overhang for governments and, you know, potentially some heightened risk aversion and weaker balance sheets for business, such that we're going to need policy settings which are as conducive as they possibly can be to investment and growth. So I think, in a way, the long-term view is coming back a bit, and it remains very important, albeit there are also short-term issues that from time to time will keep governments very focused.
Yep. You mentioned the custodianship of the role, which I agree with, kind of, you know, it's a long-lasting kind of position, but it also allows you to, I suppose, have your own imprint on the Commission itself. So do you have a view of, I suppose, or an ideal in terms of what legacy you want to create for the Commission by the time that you finish up there?
Well, it's probably not a specific legacy that's identifiable ahead of time. But I think the key thing there is that there's no question that in coming in September 2018, as I did, I came into an organisation that was strong and successful. So there was no sense of, you know, this was an organisation that needed to be turned around or things had to be radically remade. The legacy that I inherited from past chairs and past, not just the chairs, but the staff and commissioners that have been a part of the commission over a long period was very, very strong. And it's an influential organisation. It's an organisation with a strong internal culture, and it's an organisation with a strong commitment to good policy and rigorous analysis. The key thing is that, as with, you know, even successful institutions can kind of have their vulnerabilities born of their success, because you need to ensure that you're continually adapting, evolving to meet the circumstances of the day, and you can't get too trapped in past successes and past business models, but you have to maintain the best of what you've got. So mainly for me, I think it's a matter of continuing to evolve such that we remain influential in the modern day. And sometimes I think that the circumstances in which we find ourselves change, and the pandemic is a good example of that.
Yeah.
One of the other things I think we've endeavoured to do much more of is to try to build the influence or improve the influence of our ideas with a bit of what I describe as after-sales service. So I think we increasingly need to think of the generation of, you know, generating a detailed, long, weighty report as being, you know, still a large portion of the value of our product, but it's only a portion. It's not the end of the story. There's a lot of the value in our product is effectively what we then, you know, the service bit, to use the economic metaphor, you know, if we're shifting a bit from the good to the service after the event, particularly with decision makers within government, particularly in the bureaucracy. When a report lands and, yeah, it's long and it's detailed and it's got a lot of analysis that underpins it, it can be a bit overwhelming, particularly for people who are time poor. And often there's a good opportunity for us to be in there explaining things. Often we can give a sense of what led us down to particular conclusions. And often we can even provide a bit of a sense as they then grapple with a potential government response and they're looking at trade-offs and they're looking to prioritise potentially. Sometimes they're looking at alternatives. And there are instances even within our remit that where we can help we can help them think through those problems. I mean, we have to be a bit careful about it because we want to be clear that the, you know, our advice as per the report still stands, but there's no point being completely passive about what happens after the report lands if that it just compromises the likelihood of good ideas and good policy that have been thought about deeply getting up. And so we've tried to put a lot more effort into that in a measured way. It doesn't mean a whole lot of public advocacy. It doesn't necessarily mean we're lobbying ministers and what have you. That's not really our game. But it does mean ensuring that the full context, background, underpinnings of the report are well understood in policymaking circles.
Yeah, which makes sense, I think. And because a lot of the reports you do are quite detailed, but it's also there's a lot of time and effort that's allowed for, you know, to go into those reports to get into that kind of level of detail, that level of understanding that when it drops on, you know, the bureaucracy side, on, you know, whoever the recommendations and that are for, they may not have the same amount of time or, you know, ability to get into that kind of same level of detail. So helping that comprehension and being able to understand where the commission and their staff are coming from, I think is your key component. So it doesn't just become, you know, a large kind of reference document that no one reads the whole document because they are quite lengthy at times. It's there for reference for future purposes. But the more you can help people understand where you're coming from, then I think that can only be a positive thing.
I think that's right. I mean, the other thing is when you spend a year or up to a year doing these things, and as I mentioned before, there's that institutionalized public facing bit, which is both on inquiries, public hearings, but it's the receipt of submissions, but it's also just the informal consultations that we undertake. So we did a report. It was a bit atypical for us, but a report on expenditure in the Northern Territory on child and family services, which had us doing a lot of consultation on the ground, going to remote Indigenous communities, as well as major regional centres in the NT. And the point is you learn a lot. You learn a lot by talking to people, just by observation, by osmosis, really, that you sort of absorb a whole lot of implicit knowledge, which is you're trying as best you can to explain in the written report, but you'll always do it a bit imperfectly. Yep. So it's natural that someone, in addition to reading the report, or let's say reading the overview and maybe the recs and findings, there's a bit of knowledge that's implicit in the people who've gone and done the work that you want to try and download by other means. So sometimes a conversation or two, you know, or more with policymakers that just taps into all of the things that we learnt and observed and the judgments that we formed in the course of doing that work can be very valuable.
At A3, our kind of fundamental purpose is to make better decisions. That kind of, you know, as a consulting firm, that's kind of, you know, a large focus of what we do. That stems from, you know, our experience in advising kind of various industries and governments over a number of years. And one of the key kind of things that underpins that kind of philosophy is really that we kind of think that, you know, making better decisions can have a massive impact on, you know, having better outcomes for society, and address, you know, key issues, you know, that are currently faced, you know, all around the world, not just in water and kind of other kind of industries that we generally work in. So from your perspective, having that kind of, you know, overarching kind of view and a lot of kind of policy input and advice kind of stuff, what are some of the key factors from your perspective in terms of, you know, ensuring that decision makers can make better decisions going forward?
I think it's a good question. I mean, all of us play a role, obviously, in that, and in our own different ways. And so one thing that I think supports good decision-making is whether you've got the right institutional setup that provides the support to decision-makers to make those decisions, which is a combination of organisations like ours, which are probably more focused on the longer term and trying to do some deep thinking on a particular area in detail, but then high-quality people that are in the public service, close to the government, but in both the central agencies, but also the relevant line agencies that can balance those day-to-day demands with still having a longer-term view. I think things like having a degree of independence, you know, having a degree of, you know, preparedness on the part of government to hear divergent views and diverse sources of advice, I think those things are important. But I think the ex post accountability is also very important. I mean, in one sense, what makes democracies work effectively, and we shouldn't beat ourselves up, you know, in a lot of ways, in my view, is in Australia, the quality of decision making is actually very good. you know, the quality of people that we all like to bag out institutions of government. The truth is Australia is a well-governed country by any objective measure.
Yeah, I think it comes from maybe people's expectations as well.
Of course.
You know, if you do a relative comparison with some other countries, well, then obviously we're going to stack up a lot better.
That's right. So, and it's natural. People have got high expectations, as they should, and that's what, you know, makes us all keen to improve. So it's an important spur to continually getting better. But to me, it's not just about, you know, are our decision makers making, as it were, the right decision in some objective scientific sense, because let's face it, often the circumstances are so complex, so uncertain, there is no right answer ex ante. You're kind of gathering information, making judgments. There's a bit of evidence, but there's a lot of judgment that's required. And what really matters is that people are accountable for the decisions that they make. The essence of good democratic decision making isn't always the quality of the decision up front. It's the quality of the accountability process after the event. And that's a combination of things. That's about having a, you know, a free and robust media, but it's about institutional settings like audit offices, requirements to evaluate programs, you know, ideally a commitment to trialing things, piloting things, seeing how they work, then rolling them out more broadly. So a little bit of humility and caution at times. So I think it's often those things that add to the quality over the long term, the quality of decision making. And, you know, because you can't always, you know, sometimes we always want to find some holy grail that will improve the quality of decision making up front, but that's hard. We've got to acknowledge it. That's a hard thing, and the pressures and constraints on decision makers are very, very significant.
Yeah, and there's always uncertainty associated with a lot of decisions as well. You're having to, in a sense, forecast future events, you know, make decisions in the here and now that are, you know, quite definitive. And so then there's other kind of things as well, which I think, you know, you kind of touched on with the pilots and that kind of stuff. These things like, you know, the real options analysis, that kind of stuff, where you can kind of, you know, make decisions, you know, almost like no regrets kind of things, where rather than making a big bang kind of decision, you can make, you know, break a decision down into stages so that you can kind of, you know, reassess, you know, the future scenario, you know, after you've done some level of investment, and then kind of determine whether or not you should continue down that path or change tack.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think one of the great things about, to me, one of the great values in understanding the real options framework is, for me at least, and where I see it, it's less about that it's quantitative or numerical precision. There will be in some instances, you know, where you can really quantify a probability distribution and you have a really robust sense of what new information becomes available at different time periods. There's a degree of quantification you can put on the optimal strategy, I think,
yep.
And you can kind of, yeah, almost put some values at different points on the decision tree. But I think it's the qualitative intuition that really is, that's where the power exists, particularly for policymaking, because
yep.
Policymaking is replete with uncertainty. But you can't just sort of wallow in the uncertainty and say, oh, well, I can't do anything because I just don't know. And so trying to tame the uncertainty, accepting it, but trying to tame the uncertainty and using some of those basic, powerful qualitative insights from real options analysis, like that the greater the uncertainty, the more value there is in flexibility, the more, but you have to be disciplined about what new information will come along when that would change your position and your strategy. And so it's never about waiting and seeing indefinitely. You've got to know exactly when to cash in your flexibility. But the other thing is that sometimes you build flexibility through early action. You know, sometimes you impose you incur a cost up front, and that's the thing that keeps your options open.
Yeah.
I think those things are actually, they're powerful intuitions that people understand them innately, but you still have to apply a little bit of qualitative rigor to them, because otherwise there's the risk that, as I say, people will either want to maintain flexibility indefinitely, which is not always the right course, or they will dither where they need to act decisively in order to maintain a degree of optionality, as is often the case. And those, yeah, I think that understanding that basic framework is probably the important thing.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned earlier, which I agree with, that the majority of decisions are generally pretty good in the Australian kind of context, both from government or industry. One thing I was going to touch on is the fact that, we now have vast quantities of data and analytical tools that we probably didn't have, decades ago. But then decades ago, we were still probably making good decisions back then. And I don't know, at least in my mind, that it's clear that we've actually started improving, the outcomes that we're able to get from those decisions, even though we have access to so much more information available to us. So I guess that may or may not be true from your perspective, but I guess how do we ensure the available data and tools are used effectively to get the best outcomes, given that we have so much available to us these days?
I think it's a very pertinent point, actually, as to, has the quality of decision-making improved given that the tools, in one sense, for decision-making seem to be better now in terms of more information, more data. Yeah, and it's a hard question to answer, but it's probably actually a hard case to make. In one sense, a lot of decisions were made in the past where the detailed data might have been lacking, but there was a lot of intuition, a lot of judgment, a lot of anecdote, and that sort of thing that fed into decision making.
And there may have been less probably dynamic changes in the economy and broader kind of society than what there are now, given there's quite a higher rate of change in certain industries.
Yeah. I mean, this is a slight diversion, but there's probably an interesting dichotomy between when we look back on decisions that many of us would regard as significant and positive changes that were made in economic policy making. So, for example, the reduction in tariff barriers and trade protection, the opening up of the Australian economy, but also floating the exchange rate, deregulating financial markets, reforming government business enterprises and the like. Some of those decisions, I think you can say there was a strong evidence base and a very strong process of harnessing that evidence base ahead of the decision. And the trade protection one is probably the standout for that, because you had institutions like the Tariff Board who were basically given the task of going away and looking at what is the optimal rate of tariff for this very often niche industry, do the analysis, what can we say? And it was a combination of first principles, a partial equilibrium diagram, but with a bit of quantitative, where you could get the quantitative data, you'd try and put that in and you'd get the views and try and understand the complexity of the industry through firsthand or kind of dealing with stakeholders and hearing their accounts. So that's an instance where I think there was a long and painstaking process of understanding the consequences of the decisions up front, trying to invest as much as possible in informing the decision. A lot of the other decisions that were taken that were the kind of famously cited policy reforms of the 80s and 90s, national competition policy, reform of government business enterprises, floating the dollar, they were much more judgment-based when you think about it. I mean, there was not a long and detailed process to, in the lead-up to a thing like NCP that sort of said, here are the, there might have been attempts to work out the benefits ex ante. I mean, actually, the most famous estimates were done after the event by our predecessor organisation about what the benefits of NCP might be. So I think, your data and analytics are really strong in informing decision-making, but often a lot of decisions and a lot of perfectly good decisions get made with a strong element of judgment. We shouldn't forget that as much as we kind of exhort decision-makers to make as much use of the evidence as possible. The key thing I think about data and its proliferation, I think it has been hugely beneficial on two fronts. We have data sources now which are much more, either have very, very large sample sizes or they're a complete population as distinct from the sample. So sampling error in some ways has become less of an issue and it's become much more real time. So I'll look at what the Bureau of Statistics has done in the current pandemic with the single touch payroll data that they've got from the ATO. It's a vast sample. It's really, it is a whole population, but it's also very, very timely. And so it's an interesting, two things that are interesting. It's a whole new kind of area for the ABS to be in, which I think is really positive, something David Gruen has really pushed. But it's also, there's an element of public value creation in the fact that you have this ATO-led kind of digital system, basically, that then one of the byproducts of it is it generates this data flow that kind of then becomes a public good for the rest of us to understand things. So I think data is improving. It kind of is a game changer. It is revolutionary. The thing is always just to be, like with all these things, it's not about being glass half empty. I want to be glass half full about it, but you've got to understand the limitations. And I think the key limitation with data is data won't make the decisions for you. So I've always been a skeptic of the idea that you can just put all the data into the algorithm or something and it'll sort of tell you a lot of answers, as it were, revealing the answers to mysteries, you know, and just kind of, you know, mysteriously giving you the solutions to problems. I think you've got to start with your own hypothesis. Yeah, the data is powerful for testing hypotheses. And you've got to start with
that decision.
Correct. You've got to start with your first principles view, that judgment-based view, and you've got to be prepared to rigorously test against the data, and you've got to be prepared to let it go when the data tells you otherwise. But the idea that the data of itself, you know, you can just listen to the data, I am skeptical of that. I'm willing to be persuaded, but I'm still old-fashioned enough to take the view that I think there's a human element up front, which is start with your hypotheses, form a hypothesis, identify the data that would disprove it, and be honest enough to accept when it's been disproven, rather than going in, as it were, with a blank bit of paper.
Yep. As consultants, we're, you know, primarily advisors and generally advising, you know, decision makers, not always privy to the actual decision itself. And at the PC, not that you're consultants, but, you know, it is that similar kind of advisory kind of role to government. And you touched on earlier about the after sales kind of stuff that you're now kind of, you know, looking to try and do to try and make sure that the information that you guys provide and the reports that get done, you know, are able to be utilised to their full capacity and, you know, more comprehensively understood. I suppose, is there any other kind of process that you use or other kind of things to help ensure that, you know, the advice that gets provided, you know, is used appropriately and able to actually positively influence decisions?
So I think in the short term, it's mainly that process of after-sales service and trying broadly to make sure that the recommendations, the findings that we've made are well understood. And sometimes there's a public-facing element to that. We don't overdo it, but we will get out there and communicate those things publicly. And then often, as I say, helping policymakers trying to navigate that maze as well. There's probably another dimension to it too, which is that there are some reports we do which are kind of quite moored or anchored in the here and now. You know, the government, it's kind of evident from the terms of reference, the government is focused on a particular problem and they're after some solutions that are tested and evidence-based. And that's what we endeavour to provide. And that's then amenable to an immediate government response about what things they might take up and which things not. There are other instances and reports that we might do which are subtly less about the here and now, but they might be more about changing the way people think about an issue. And often there what we're trying to do is, yes, ideally give government some actionable recommendations in the here and now, but we're also trying to influence policy making and thinking in a slightly broad and intangible way, but a real way nonetheless, over time. And sometimes that means, you know, you can write a report that will, as it were, sit on the shelf. But reports can sit on the shelf in a good way or a bad way. There are worse places to sit than on a shelf, right? And you know, there are, I can think of reports that spring to mind. The Henry Tax Review is an example. You know, it sort of sits on the shelf, but in many ways it is still the authoritative account of what good tax policy, starting from our starting point, ought to look like for Australia. And it gets consulted regularly in that light. So sometimes that's our role. You know, sometimes we want to be influential in having the right, you know, well-based recommendations that are actionable now. But often it's we want to kind of change thinking and have a product that may not necessarily have short-term influence but has that longer-term slow-burn influence.
Yeah, and I can speak to my own. I know, I think I mentioned to you before, there was a review done a while ago in public infrastructure. That's a similar kind of thing. It's largely, you know, it's quite a large, you know, couple of volume kind of thing, but quite detailed. And so I know myself and I know others have kind of referred back to that, you know, from the PC's website because it is there and it's quite a good, account and record of, kind of good practice that can last. It's not just a, one-off kind of point in time. You can actually keep on referring to it in the future.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And sometimes the distinction is between big issues versus small issues, but not always. There are some big issues where the government might be after something that's actionable here and now. Oftentimes there's a seemingly smaller issue, but one where we might actually be interested more in, as I put it, changing the way people think about the issue.
Yeah, changing the perceptions, which can take a while.
Yeah.
You previously did a speech to WASA. I did some research. I had actually read it a while ago. And one of the things you noted was that, the roles of policymaking and investment decision in the industry had largely been separated, highlighting the positive kind of thing of, that separating and clearly having that distinction of the two roles. But over time, I guess there's an increasing relationship between policy and investment decisions. They become quite, a lot of policy impacts on investment decisions, quite directly. So I suppose if we have those two separate roles, that they are kind of that overlapping kind of thing, how do we ensure that those kind of two roles kind of collaborate effectively and so we get the most efficient outcome for customers going forward?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I don't have a great answer in a way, but other than to say, I think the basic narrative that you've sketched out holds that we saw very significant benefits, I think, from the 1990s onwards in that wave of reform, in particularly in regulated infrastructure, in water, energy, gas, and the like, ports. Yep. By moving to that degree of separation, establishing entities with a clear corporate mission, boards, capital policy, and economic regulation around pricing and investment decisions, and, well, particularly around pricing, around cost recovery. And then, I think we gained significant productivity benefits associated with that wave of reform. And I think you're right, we increasingly observe in areas like water that the separation, whilst beneficial, can also be a barrier to getting the right policy outcome at times, because we've got an entity that's essentially got a delivery mandate that might not necessarily be taking broader account of some other policy considerations. And so whose role is it? And you either have a big coordination problem or a problem of, it's nobody's responsibility and maybe things kind of fall between the cracks and you can get a bit of confusion. My basic instinct on it is that the model that we've got, you don't want to change it fundamentally because it's delivered the benefits that it has, and it's not clear to me that the more blurred set of accountabilities would do better than what we've got. But that's an instinct. It's not a disposition. I can't claim to have thought deeply about it or really looked hard at the evidence. So I think it's probably more about do you have the what is the role of the policymaker? I mean, part of the problem may have been that we have almost allowed the economic regulation of the utility sector. Sometimes it's almost become a victim of its success. It's been so successful and so powerful a model that sometimes other players in the process have forgotten their role. And I've sort of privately made that observation in the past about the shareholder role. I think sometimes the shareholder role's been diminished because it was almost as though, the economic regulator was looking after the investment decisions almost of the entities, whereas in fact the shareholder really ought to be taking a proactive position. But
and that the regulator becomes responsible for pricing as opposed to shareholders, the pricing decisions.
That's right. And I think and that is a function of the fact that we set up a very successful, strong, dominant model, if you like, and other people maybe couldn't quite see their role once you had that in place. And maybe there's an element of that with policymaking, that there was too much or has been too much of a sense that the system sort of runs itself.
Mm. Is there part, and I agree with that separation of the roles and the benefits that have come from that. One of the things that just comes to me is the thing of potential information asymmetry in terms of, policy decision makers aren't privy to the detailed information that the, the service providers, the ones that are actually going to be making the investments have. And so they may be making it, there may be some kind of, interaction and collaboration, but they're not going to have the same level of detailed understanding of what impact the policy decisions are going to have.
Mm. Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think that's always a bit of a challenge in policy making and a hard thing to overcome.
Yeah. Yeah. In a slight change of tact and talk about value in decision making. The majority of decisions that we see in a lot of, you know, the regulated industries, you know, that we deal with, primarily focus on the financial, the cost perspective in terms of decision making, and don't really have a lot of consideration for, you know, the potential economic, social, environmental kind of value of different options. It's generally focused on, you know, the least cost in order to deliver certain services. But in my mind, at least, you know, there is this distinct difference between, you know, the value that customers get from a certain product or service and the cost, you know, in terms of actually providing it. I suppose, how, you know, regulated industries are a little bit different in terms of, you know, customers don't have a choice. You know, they have to pay the bills essentially for those regulated services, which are, you know, natural monopolies. They are regulated by economic regulators and for the most part generally focus on cost in terms of, you know, because that then feeds into pricing. How do we kind of, I suppose, incorporate that kind of consideration or bridge that gap a bit between, you know, the cost of actually providing a service and the value that customers actually get from that?
Yeah, and again, I don't have a perfect answer. I suspect that in a context like a natural monopoly, which is regulated, there's an inevitable tension, and you have to kind of weigh up what, you know, how much, to pardon the pun, but how much value is there in a more value-focused lens versus let's just extract the benefits that you can get out of a cost containment and an efficiency lens. So going back to my earlier point, no question that the reforms of the 1990s imposed significant discipline, particularly significant capital discipline on these natural monopolies, which is capital intensive businesses, and drove productivity improvements. And you see it in the total factor productivity stats over that period for the utilities sector that they rose significantly. Now, in a sense, we've subsequently given back some of those gains, and particularly you can see how that happened in cases like electricity transmission and distribution, where there were, in some states, more stringent reliability requirements that were brought in. Now, in a way, you could see that as the value that you're talking about. You know, it results in a measured fall in productivity. It results in a big increase in price per unit of output, so the prices faced by the consumer passed on via the retailers. But someone somewhere has made a judgment that there's value in the greater reliability standard. Now, always the question in these industries is that a view that's actually shared by the consumer? Does it really reflect willingness to pay at the consumer end? Now, in energy, maybe you can test that a little bit more because you can find, you know, more innovative pricing structures that allow you to test the genuine revealed preference of consumers about, you know, are they really prepared to pay for that reliability on the hottest day of the year or, you know, during the peak times and the like, and there are market mechanisms. I think in water that's much harder to get, though I'm open to the idea that you might be able to kind of extract something that's a revealed preference around reliability or the desire not to trigger water restrictions in a dry period, those sorts of things. But one of the challenges, of course, is that you, for the most part, the efforts to try and measure the value, and you're absolutely right, you know, part of the challenge here is we don't have prices in the conventional sense. We don't have prices like you do in a competitive market that kind of give you information about consumer willingness to pay and, you know, in a kind of competitive structure. But part of the challenge is a lot of the modelling techniques that you might employ to try and elicit a willingness to pay are difficult because they tend to rely on a state of preference, and it's hard to avoid some element of state of preference, which is just a bit unreliable, you know, and unreliable and prone to misuse, I think, in informing a regulator's pricing decision.
Yep.
So I think it's hard. I mean, it is not impossible that, you know, when you weigh up all of the pros and cons, you just come to the view that, well, what do consumers really want fundamentally from utility-like services? They want reliability at least cost, and that's value enough. And so the economic regulation we've got, whilst not perfect, if it can drive that outcome, that's enough. But it's a good question to have, I think, because as we see, tried to bring out a bit in the paper that we put out recently on integrated water cycle management, you know, there is increasingly these other perceptions, or not just perceptions, the reality of value that associated with aspects of water provision that are hard to incorporate into that conventional economic regulated water utility model.
That's the traditional kind of, you know, model is essentially, you know, supplying water, taking away sewage and treating it on both sides, and maybe, you know, a bit of trade waste and stormwater kind of stuff. But now the definition of the water industry is kind of, you know, increasingly kind of considering other aspects of, you know, where, how water interacts, you know, with the general kind of environment and the natural habitats and all that kind of stuff. And then it's kind of, you know, that thing of trying to work out where those roles and responsibilities lie between, you know, local governments and state governments and, you know, water utilities, and so who should be doing what, which I think is a, quite a grey area at the moment in terms of, you know, not only who should be doing what, but then kind of going, well, how much should be spent on that, because, you know, what do customers value it at? You know, and are customers actually willing to pay? You get, you know, the regulated, like you were saying, you know, competitive environment, people can choose to, you know, not purchase the product if they don't see value in it. You know, if it doesn't, it's not value for money for them, they won't buy it, and therefore you get that direct feedback straight away, knowing that, well, we've set the price too high for that one. In regulated monopolies, you know, people don't have that choice necessarily to, you know, to not consume that product and not pay the bill. And so you may get some that are willing to pay and others aren't.
Mm.
And but then you're essentially going to be having one price for everyone, and then it's kind of, you know, balancing that trade-off of, you know, what people are willing to pay and how you apply that across the whole customer base.
Yeah. And the other thing, of course, in a private market is that you've got the function of entrepreneurship. You've got someone taking a risk, putting out, you know, going out there with a new product, trying to get support for it. They either succeed or fail. You can't replicate that easily in the water sector. So you're trying to substitute for what a market might generate in terms of long-term marginal cost pricing and the like by fiat, by regulation. And that's, you know, it's hard for regulators to substitute for entrepreneurs. The other point, you're quite right, when you've got some of these broader goals like habitat or urban cooling or just, you know, the amenity associated with a wetland or something that are over and above the traditional view of what water services have been, it is important to ask, you know, who delivers that, and partly through the lens of who's well qualified to deliver that, because culturally you've got a lot of entities with very distinct, their own distinct cultures, like the culture in a water business is very different from the culture in a local council to an environmental regulator to an economic regulator to a private sector developer, you know, whatever. But the other thing is that by default, when you attribute a responsibility to a particular player in that mosaic, you're often implicitly making a judgment about who should pay, because if the water authority is funding something, then that's probably a cost that's going to be built into the regulated asset base and going to be passed on through pricing, either a unit price or a fixed component of a tariff, but probably across the catchment. If it's funded by council, you know, it'll be reflected in rates, so maybe it's a little more granular because it's that local council, but maybe it's the ratepayers as a whole, you know, are they all necessarily getting the benefit equally? If it's the developer, it's much more user pays associated with a particular housing development, but does that, you know, if there is a habitat or an urban cooling effect, you know, is it a little broader than just that immediate development? Should the state pay? The part of the challenge is, you know, the question about who should deliver these things inevitably gets you into a decision about who should pay, because they have their own unique ways of funding their services. And you've got to think hard about who are the beneficiaries and where should we target that cost recovery.
Yeah. And part of that also, I think, from the water industry's perspective, there's scope, similar to in other ones, primarily electricity, I guess, in terms of tariff structures. So in terms of the water industry itself, it's generally a simple kind of tariff structure, I'd say, that hasn't changed for the last, I don't know, probably a couple of decades since they came in terms of, you know, it's generally a fixed price and variable charge that, you know, sometimes has an inclining block, but there's never been really any kind of consideration of, do we set, you know, have a different tariff that customers can opt into? You know, that, you know, like what you can have with electricity, you can opt into certain things. It's generally been just one tariff across the board, with a view, I think, from utilities that billing systems aren't necessarily currently capable of dealing with all that kind of stuff, and so therefore they have a simple kind of tariff structure that essentially means it gets applied to everyone. Or they may have some geographic kind of boundaries, but there's no kind of flexible opt-in or scenarios or anything like that that could help deal with that kind of, you know, beneficiary pays and, you know, that willingness to pay.
Yeah, and it's always been a question in my mind about how, you know, whether the cost recovery principle ought to flow right through. So should you just have a fixed component on the bill that reflects the fixed cost of the business, which are most of it, or is it okay to have greater variability at the retail interface to recover some fixed costs for the entity itself, and the entity kind of taking a bit of a risk on usage, as it were. Yep. And I haven't thought enough or researched that question enough, but you're right that it's a much simpler and one size fits all pricing policy in water than it is in other regulated utilities.
Yeah. So in terms of decision making, one thing in my mind that kind of gets overlooked quite a bit, and we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, is that, you know, the subsequent realisation of the benefits or the outcomes after the initial decision. So there's a lot of focus that gets done on, you know, the ex ante kind of thing of leading up to the decision and, you know, what this decision is going to deliver and all this kind of stuff. But then there's not very little consideration and then very little resourcing kind of thing, if any, that gets dedicated to actually ensuring the value from the investment is actually able to be realised. So I suppose, do you agree with that kind of statement? And then do you have any views on how that could be overcome, if so?
Yeah, I do agree with it. And I think it's true in a whole range of context, right, from hard investment decisions, but also policy decisions and the like. And in a way, you can see it as stemming from a couple of innate natural human tendencies. One, that decision making is hard, and so there is a bit of a tendency once you've made the decision, and we've all had it, you know, when you have an agonising decision, once you've made the decision, the most salient feeling after that is one of relief.
Yep.
Oh, now I've made the decision, you know, and so you just want to move on, and then you want to confront the next thing and the next thing. You don't really want to be revisiting, you know, do I have regrets or do I, you know, did I get out of that decision what I wanted to? And sometimes, well, in your personal life, it's probably not all that fruitful thing to do, right, because you don't, you know, you just want to go with it.
Yep.
But I think, I think there's that. I think the other thing is that within an organisation, for example, you know, a decision has often been agonised over, but ultimately it's somebody's responsibility, and then for that somebody, they're pretty invested in the decision, and they're going to be a little defensive potentially about any effort to kind of go back and review, was it the right call? I mean, the point about post-benefit realisation is it doesn't have to necessarily be a reflection on quality of the decision-making up front.
No.
And that's particularly true going back to when we talk about the intuition behind real options. Often what you're trying to go for is some modular approach such that, of course, you're going to want that ongoing review because you're trying to maintain a bit of flexibility and then determine what's the new information. Yeah, where are we now at in the decision tree? Should we shift gears? Do we keep going? Do we pause for a while? Those things. So in a way, rigorous post-decision evaluation is part and parcel of taking that flexible modular approach up front too, I think. And it should be seen almost as part of an ongoing decision-making process. But it is hard for those reasons, and I think there are natural reasons why people want to, you know, they're kind of a little defensive about revisiting past decisions. But, you know, you can definitely learn from them. And often, even if you haven't explicitly gone down a modular path, if you don't think you're getting the benefits that you thought you might, there is often something you can do to try and extract more of those benefits. But, of course, also in a world of uncertainty and endogeneity and path dependence, you're probably also getting all sorts of benefits that you hadn't counted on, that just you never really thought about, or there have been these other byproducts or side effects, and it's good just to be reflective about that, I think. So, yeah, I think there is a big role for a sort of benefits realisation piece after the event, and I suspect part of the reason it doesn't happen is because people can't quite see the point. You know, they sort of think, well, it's a sunk cost, it's done.
Yep.
No point revisiting it, and you know, it only looks like a witch hunt about how a decision was come to. But
I think
that's the other thing. We have great difficulty as human beings kind of making the distinction between what was a good decision up front, good decision ex ante that may not have had a good outcome you know, it was probably a good decision to back the favourite. The favourite didn't win. Still was a pretty good decision up front, knowing what you knew. But
I think you mentioned at the start about that, you know, the role of accountability in terms of making, you know, having a good decision-making kind of approach. And that accountability, you can have, it's a different accountability in terms of making the decision versus, you know, that maybe a different person or different institution that's responsible and accountable for the actual realising of the benefits. You know, there can be actually two different kind of components to that, you know, it's not just one person accountable for the whole, you know, the whole stream.
Yeah, I think that's right too, because you might tend to, well, you've got to be objective, about it. You know, it's and objectivity is hard. Individuals find it hard. I think organisations find objectivity hard, but because there's always, you know, there'll be people who want to defend past decisions, that sort of thing. You have to work hard to cultivate an environment that's conducive to objectivity. I remember I once had a a boss who would go and do a speech or something, and you know, kind of come back and say, well, purportedly ask for feedback, but basically sort of couch the whole thing in terms of, yeah, that was pretty good, wasn't it? You know, I did that, you know, I got that line in, that was good. Yeah, I really liked the way I did that, you know. And I mean, I was a young person at the time, and I remember sort of thinking, yeah, well, you haven't really created an environment that's conducive to a really candid exchange of, well, you know, this worked, that didn't, maybe next time we'll do this, you know. And partly because, you know, everyone's human, they want a bit of reassurance too, and confidence is an important ingredient as well. Yeah. But you know, it's you've got to work at it, is the point, I guess, to cultivate an environment that's conducive to objectivity, where people are going to tell the boss they're wrong, or people are going to say, you know, the thing we did last week that we thought was a great idea, it actually turns out maybe it wasn't, but here's how we can make it okay. That's a big challenge, I think, because it requires a lot of honesty and humility.
Yeah. We're coming towards the end, so I feel I'd ask a question, I'll bring it back up. Bit more overarching about, you know, the person, Michael Brennan himself. So given where you're at in terms of, you know, you've become the chair of the PC and, you know, I'll say, you know, you're a relatively young person given the position that you're in and what you've been able to achieve thus far.
Relative to what?
Successes, I guess. So if you could go back 20 years or so, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Yeah, that's a good question. A totally unrealistic question, but it's a good one to ponder. So,
back to the future.
Yeah. I mean, I like I say, young relative to what I am. So I'm 49. I think back to, you know, when I was in my 20s, the advice that I'd give to myself is, work harder. I don't know, but that would be vain. I think that there's a few things. One of the things that I probably do reflect on a bit is that when you're in your 20s, you probably overthink your career choices in a way that you ought not. It matters much more how you do things rather than what you do. So as long as you're doing well at what you're doing and giving it your all and taking great pride in it, I think that's much more important than what you do. I think when I look, I did it a bit, or I was guilty of this a bit, but I see young people doing it today, you know, trying to kind of build the career through building blocks and sort of saying, well, I'll do this and then I'll do that and then this would be the right step for me and that sort of thing. It's good to be conscious of the choices you're making, but don't overthink it, because what's actually much more important is, you know, you can go away and do something totally different for a while, and as long as you're giving it your all and you're doing it well, it's amazing how you can then reconnect with past streams of your career. So there were a number of points where I thought, you know, I was at some fork in the road where I was choosing crucially between going down one path, going down another. Truth of the matter is, either path might well have led me back to where I am now. And so you don't, you know, these things aren't quite the big forks in the road. The other thing, I mean, my own career was pretty non-linear, you know, so I'd done a bunch of other things. You know, I had a few, you know, I've worked for a while in ministerial office. I worked in the Kennett government, for example, and then that all came to a screeching halt in 1999, you know, when
unexpectedly.
Through an unexpected election defeat, you know, so that totally changed my, you know, I lost my job and totally kind of changed my, what would have been under a different scenario, my career path after that. And so there are a lot of non-linearities and they're a good thing. And I do look sometimes at the, I think it's particularly true in the public service, one of the worries I have about young people coming into the service, because they're very bright, talented people, and they've actually done an extraordinary amount, you know, in their undergraduate studies and extracurricular activities and the like. But particularly in the APS in Canberra, I think it's true that there's then a very, very strong focus on promotion and the speed of promotion within the ranks, yeah, because it's meaningful to people. That's how you gain a bit of self-esteem and a sense of self-worth, and it's how you work out if you're doing well or not, how you're going relative to your cohort.
Yep.
But it's a drug, you know. It's a toxic and addictive drug. This idea of fast linear advancement, which really is going to not count for that much. When you're 50, you know that how fast you got from one position to the next in your 20s really is immaterial.
Yep.
Much better off going off doing interesting things, suffering some setbacks, building a bit of character, broadening yourself, you know, having a bit of fun. I think that's more important in the long run. And so whether I say that, that'd probably be a dangerous message to give to my 20-year-old self. But, you know, I think it's true for a lot of people. I worry that they can get a bit channeled on a pretty narrow linear path because it's there and they're goal-oriented people and they just want to meet the next milestone. And I sometimes think that needs to be shaken up a bit.
Yeah. Yep. It's that uncertainty and including it within your life.
Yeah, well, it is partly because, if you start, for example, in the Australian Public Service and your goal is to become a secretary or a deputy secretary, I don't know that you'll get there by organic, promotion within, and maybe you shouldn't. And part of the reason why you may not is because the world around you is going to change. So that what looks like a linear path is not really a linear path anyway. It's going to be disrupted by external events. So it is the uncertainty bit. And the key to uncertainty and dealing with uncertainty is not about being able to predict what's going to happen. It's really about how you adjust when the uncertainty occurs.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time, Michael. There was quite a lot of good insights there and kind of helpful advice in terms of decision making and kind of useful things to take forward, I think, which was quite useful. So thanks for that.
No worries. Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me.